Welcome to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games and how we love them.
Oh wow, this is a change in the remit to the show.
I am Michael Walker, and I'm here with my good friend, Mark Bigney, and we are So Very Wrong About Games.
That we are. And under the context of being our So Very Wrong, I would like to issue a sincere apology. I made an offhand reference in our Pledge of Indifference show, where I was woefully incorrect. I was attempting to make a reference to Ed Sullivan, and I mistakenly said Johnny Carson. So I would like to apologize for that error.
Did you see when I put the card to my head, that was the Johnny Carson?
That was Johnny Carson, yeah. But I was referencing Ed Sullivan. Now, of course, I haven't watched either of these two individuals. Number one, because I am not what's the word ancient, and number two, because I don't really like late-night television to begin with, because I go to bed as though I were ancient. So
Fred Mine has a great shirt. It's on. It says, old as dirt. It's amazing. I love it.
Well, there
he
wears
you go. It to the gym.
So we are going to be talking about board games this week. We're going to talk about the games we played last week, the news, and why it doesn't matter. And then we are going to be reviewing our feature game, which this week is Galactic Renaissance by Christian Martinez and Matago. Walker, what did you play last week?
Mark, I got Veil of Eternity back to the table. This is designed by Eric Hong and put out by Mandu Games. And it is a card game where you're sort of building your tableau. You can have as many cards out as the round number. The game goes for 10 rounds, and you're just trying to generate victory points. And the art is very interesting and charming, but this really brought out the fact that someone that knows the game is going to have a very large leg up to someone who does not know the game.
Oh, sure.
They see the cards that are coming out. They know how they can combo. They now know how useful they are. And so it was very lopsided, this game. But still, I still enjoy it. It was only two-player. Maybe that wouldn't have played out so much in a four-player game, but
I'd be more curious to see how the drafting would work in a higher player count game. I too, have only played it two-player, and there my primary objection was the drafting element, because, as you say, Veil of Eternity is a tableau-building game where you're building combos, but the important thing to note is that only some cards generate victory points. And if you have those cards that generate victory points come up, someone can either draft them or hate draft them, case depending, and they can effectively just profit from turn order. They don't come out at a regular interval. They come off randomly off the shuffled deck. So with more players and with more cards in any individual flop, I would hope that that factor would recede.
It's true. And like I said, some cards will come up and they seem useless, but when you know the cards, you'll know it's going to come up soon. And if you don't have the other card, no, I'm just saying how people that know the
sure.
deck.
Sure. No, I hear you. The reason why I'm somewhat indifferent to that objection is because I can see the virtue of both positions, right? It is a feature of a game, of many games, that they reward experience more so than other ones. Typically, games with perfect information and low amounts of randomness, the experienced player is going to win 9 times out of 10. But some people prefer that. How much randomness to mitigate that is a question of taste. Now, in the case of combo builders, as Veil of Eternity kind of is, it's not really a combo builder in the same way that, say, Innovation or other Carl Chudik games is, or even a game from John Cloutis, for example. It's not quite leaning into combos that way, but as you say, having a little bit of foresight, a little bit of experience with the system will help you identify those combos before they come up. And I'm not sure that's a downside necessarily for everybody. It's worth flagging, absolutely. And some people don't like that, but a lot of people enjoy that, even to the point that if they play a game against an experienced player and win or even do competitively, that's actually a negative feature for them. So it's just worth flagging that.
True.
Hence my eh. I would like to apologize. I wasn't trying to undercut what you were saying. I was just, that was an eh of context, not an eh of undermining.
That is the Veil.
Could you tell by the inflection?
Totally.
Could you? I just want to be.
You've got several ehs, and I've nailed them all down. It's all good.
Yeah, good.
And that is The Veil of Eternity by Eric Hong.
Finished my game of Voidfall. Voidfall is the Euro 4X designed by Nigel Buckle and David Tertze. It was our game of the year last year. I stand by it absolutely. And I had a great time navigating the vicissitudes and strengths and weaknesses of the faction that I was playing, because I'd never played that faction before. I was able to get out 5 agendas. Normally you're limited to 4, but this faction in particular, it has an advanced tech that can get up to 5 agendas, which means that you're scoring a maximum of 5 victory conditions when everyone's scoring a maximum of 4. Getting out 4 is hard enough. Getting the condition to get 5 and then get 5 out was an interesting ride, because they have a variety of factional advantages that make them slightly better at accumulating those cards in the first place, and specifically the agendas. That part was great. However, Voidfall also managed to highlight some of its weaknesses in this particular play, because, as we've commented before, our group is inclined towards games with player interaction, and then sometimes is inclined not to exploit that player interaction. We've gotten better, I think. A lot of us have, certainly at identifying those features. But this was a case where Voidfall was absolutely playing into that kind of borderline degeneracy. It wasn't a degeneracy, but it was almost there. Here was the situation round about the end game, round three going forward. Which was, we had all raced towards the center hex, partially by necessity, partially because that was what was advantageous. And I had my holdings, and I was right up next to Louis, and I was right up next to the other Louis as well. And Louis had, shall we say, a death fleet. Three dreadnoughts, three cruisers, with combat techs as well. And he was defended by an impressive ring of defensive operations. I think not since the Samatra have we seen orbital defenses so sophisticated and impregnable. I had a pretty good military force, but it didn't measure up. Under normal circumstances, it would have been fine. And I think, looking at the table position, looking at the relative scores, looking at what was going on, my ability to retaliate, a reasonable position would have been time to go step on Mark's face real hard. And for what it's worth, just for context, I probably still would have won by a handy margin because, again, I had five agendas out and was scoring them. Louis, on the other hand, is not inclined to do such a thing. And indeed, I looked at that border, I looked at that developing situation and said, Louis's probably not going to be willing to pull the trigger. He really should. I almost felt like telling him, you know, you should really, I mean, come on. why are you going there? Come on. But I didn't, partially out of self-interest, partially because I knew Voidfall isn't at its best when played that way, and also partially because I just don't like telling people how to play, by and large, especially when other players are involved. So, again, this was Voidfall at its best, also Voidfall at its worst, to a certain extent. The player versus player combat, the combat itself is fine, but the way the victory conditions interact with it can be very strange, especially insofar as it's superficially appealing the way you score points by attacking somebody else's holdings. But then the more you start interrogating it, you start thinking about the dynamics of attack and counterattack, it just starts to be less appealing. But when the heads-down multiplayer or solitaire experience of Voidfall is as good as it is, I think this is merely a blemish on another, or perhaps even for some people, for some people, just a feature, not necessarily a bug. Oh, I'm sorry. I just wanted to be clear. Gotcha. I wouldn't want to get the intonation wrong. Thank you for the correction. I appreciate it, Walker. So everyone was very pleased to go back to Voidfall. Teardown was much less painful than setup, especially since it is easier for multiple people to cooperate in the teardown in a more straightforward way. I'm very happy to get Voidfall to the table. Even though this is a heavier and more Euro experience than that particular group is often inclined to go towards, Voidfall wins friends wherever it goes. It is a very particular experience, but extraordinarily well done. The design team of Nigel Buckle and David Terce continues to impress. I'm a massive fan. Looking forward to the continuation. There have been noise about expansion opportunities in Voidfall, which on the one hand is greatly appreciated. On the other hand is wild because there's already so much content in that box. So that was Voidfall.
I picked up another copy of Radlands because my copy just poof disappeared.
That's what happens when you lend things to people.
I know.
Do you know what happened? I once lent someone a copy of The Vocation of Man by Fichte. He never gave it back to me, and it's so out of print. I had to find a weird, not as good translation. It was the Hackett translation. It was really good. I assume you've read The Vocation of Man by J.G.
Sure.
Fichte.
Yeah, I have the original manuscript.
Oh wow!
Yeah, it's very interesting. He has his.
Can I see it?
No.
Oh,
it has his like sort of notes on the side. Like it was.
That's amazing.
His personal copy. Yeah,
that's amazing.
It's great. So Radlands is one of these great games that everyone draws off the same deck. You draft bases to form your three bases on the bottom, and then as you put out cards using water, you're protecting these three bases, and so you can't attack the bases if you have units in front, and you can't attack those units if you have units in front of those. So you have sort of this 3x3 grid, and you also use these grids to time events as they go into play, and so all sorts of different things are happening. Yet another post-apocalyptic game, so it always has me, and it plays very quickly, it's very easy to teach, and I just really like Radlands.
So I've only played Radlands the one time. I like two-player card battlers. It didn't impress me to the same level that it did to you. I didn't like how attritional ended up feeling. It was still very quick, but I felt that a lot of the interaction of the powers didn't quite speak to my preferences. And the same was true of Mindbug. The original Mindbug, I thought it was a clever idea, but it didn't really do enough with it. Enter Mindbug Battlefruits. So this is a review copy we got from the publisher. Battlefruits is kind of sort of the third standalone version of Mindbug. And it introduces a couple of very, very simple new mechanisms. One of them being Harvest, and one of them, which is a holdover from the previous set, which is to say actions. A couple comments first about the theme. They've really committed. So it's called Battlefruits. And right away, if you go see the crowdfunding, by the time you hear this, Mindbug Battlefruits should be on GameFound.
Yep.
And
just started.
You can take a look at some of the characters. I mean, if you had thought, look, it's called Battlefruits. Surely they don't mean, yes, they mean Battlefruits. There is a there's a pineapple paladin. There is a dragon fruit that is a dragon fruit. They've really leaned into this. It's all vegetables and fruits. It's almost the point where it's like, hats off, you've really gone to the hilt with this nonsense. I kind of appreciate it. But now I think Mindbug is in a really, really good place because the level of elaboration introduces elements of timing. That was one of the things that I didn't like about base Mindbug. Everything seemed like individual stochastic turns. It made everything feel like one shots. And at that point, you're playing something more that feels like a take that card game, even in the context of two players. But now with Harvest and the new actions, it's not trying to go into like a tableau builder or anything like that. But it really does open up the decision space and open up the considerations of what you want to play and when, and the psychology of when to steal other people's units. Because the conceit of Mindbug, for those not familiar, basically all you could do in your turn is play a card, more or less, or attack with one of the cards you've already got. Every card is a unit, and they're all busted. They're all just way too powerful. But twice during the game, after someone plays a card, you can say, no, 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 that's my card instead. So you're sitting there with a hand saying, oh yeah, this would be a great card to play now. Oh wait, but it's too good. Walker's going to steal it. Okay, better wait. And it's those level of considerations that really drive a lot of the fundamental tension of it. But then on top of that, as I say, with Battlefruits, you've got some interesting abilities. How do you think Battlefruits stacks up to the other Mindbug offerings?
For exactly like you said, yep. Adds sort of like a timing mechanism. Like you said, there is the Mindbugs. You only can do it twice in a game, and you only have 3 hit points. So the games don't last very long. Yet another single deck game, even less so, because you only give 10 cards to each player, and there's a whole, half a deck still left to play. And like you said, there's Harvest, introduces counters, and they use those in all sorts of different ways, which is nice. It's not just the standard,
Right.
It's mostly, add it or subtract it, and when that happens, it triggers an ability. So the first set that came out added actions. So the first set was just, like you said, play a card or attack with a card that was already out. Then they added actions, so you could either, play a card, activate a card you have in play, or
if it had an action associated with it, yes.
And now, like you said, they've added even more. Hope it doesn't get too out of control, but we'll see.
Well, but out of control is kind of its stock in trade. That's kind of the point. As I say, any individual card seems ridiculously overpowered. So, for example, one card that was very consequential in the game that we were playing was a card that said it comes with 2 counters on it at the top of every round, at the top of each one of your turns, that is, the controller takes away one of the tokens. While this card was in play, none of my other creatures could be defeated, which is huge. I could block with anything. I could attack with things under circumstances I wouldn't normally be able to do. I didn't care. It was wild. But the moment it loses its last token, it dies. And that's just an indication of how a single card will completely upend the play state, but it had a self-destruct timer on it. And so you were put on the back foot. You had been on a position where you had really wanted to go on offense, but this stalled you right at the time that you didn't want it to. And so it was an interesting effect. I was only able to play it, though, partially because you'd run out of Mindbugs. So there you have it.
It's true. And that is Mindbug Battlefruits.
Specifically, we played Mindbug Battlefruits Kingdom. There's also a galaxy set. So more Mindbug.
Space fruit?
You can have fruit in space.
Yeah.
Why not?
Mark was nice enough to show me a game called Ice Cool Wizards. Ice Cool Wizards, very much like the basic Ice Cool, you're flicking penguins, but in this case, there are cards all over the map. There's a card for the room, and there's a card in the corners of the room. The cards in the corners of the room are recipes, and the cards in the middle of the room are resources to fulfill those recipes. And so you're flicking, you're trying to hit as many rooms as you can while either passing through or landing in the corners, and then you simply pick up all the cards of the rooms that you pass through and all of the corner cards that you either landed on or passed through. And then you fulfill the recipes if you can. If you happen to touch the other player's penguin as you flicked it, you get to trade, quotation marks, as in with a club, you will take this and I will take that.
One of those kinds of trades.
With the resources only. You can't like trade the recipes. But other than that, it's a much smaller map than it is for normal Ice Cool, but still super fun. And the penguins flick just as good as the original.
For those of you unfamiliar, Ice Cool introduced a sort of board gaming technology whereby there were a series of nesting boxes inside the game box. And it was roughly the same size and shape of what you would find in a traditional Hasbro Monopoly size, which is to say relatively flat and relatively long rectangle. And one of the things that I really liked about Ice Cool, the original, was that there was enough scope to start getting kind of okay at trick shots in the context of a single game, because the penguin pieces, the things you're actually going to be flicking, are shockingly easy to manipulate in a variety of cool ways. I'm not talking about incredible sophistication. I'm not talking about, like, incredible precision. But if you want to be able to, you know, I'd really like to get through that door, and then I'd like to arc to the left afterwards. That was eminently doable. And I really appreciated that. That was great. A whole bunch of dexterity games either don't have components that are amenable to trick shots, or in other ones, there's an example called Bicycle, which was then redeveloped as Roadsters. You know, they talk about all these trick shots you can do. It's like, yeah, they're doable, but only if you, know, really practice at it. And I'm not going to practice at a dexterity game like it's chess. I'm sorry. That's not really what I'm in this hobby for. Anyway, so in the context of Ice Cool, that was great. Ice Cool Wizards, the boards are smaller now. This is what I was getting to. The box is smaller, and thus all the netting boxes are smaller. I really like the new recipe fulfillment element. It's just a very, very simple, bog standard. If this were a Euro game, I would trash it as an uninspired and derivative scoring mechanism. But as an add-on to a dexterity game, it works just fine. And so it really, I think, expands the interest and scope of Ice Cool. But I miss the bigger boxes. I miss the bigger boards. Because with a smaller canvas, there's less room to do those interesting shots. I understand why it's done this way, and it makes the package much cheaper and much more cheerful. I thoroughly enjoyed Ice Cool Wizards. I think I prefer it to base Ice Cool, and I was pretty enthusiastic about Ice Cool to begin with. It's just part of me wishes that I could get both at the same time. It's visually delightful. Who doesn't like penguins? And the scoring elements are simple, but as I say, add a little bit of texture to the proceedings. I highly recommend Ice Cool Wizards for gamers of all ages.
But there's a slight problem.
What's that?
Well, I feel that the school is very old, the wizard school.
Uh-huh.
And then the evolution of penguins, they've been getting taller. You see, the doorways aren't quite tall enough to let the penguins... So, like, I don't think they would normally build it that way. So I think there's this...
Walker had a bit of a problem with doors. This, I think, echoes probably Walker's experience in real life. You know, a small number of you have met us in person. We are on, shall we say, an expanded scale. And on occasion, Walker, I'm sure you've had this experience, sometimes door frames and sometimes ceilings are not meant to accommodate gentlemen of our scale.
I suppose.
And Ice Cool is very much the same way. The penguins are taller than the doors are. And this is not a problem when you're flicking. In fact, I think one of the reasons why it was done this way, I think largely it was for production reasons, but it's really an impediment only if it's near the end of the penguin's movement. Walker, however, seemed to get himself stuck in doorways all the time.
It's true.
I still enjoyed it. I think.
Oh, it didn't take away from.
No, I mean that aspect of the doors. Gotcha, I think it factored into getting through a door, because getting through a doorway is one of the ways you pick up cards. And because there are specifically cards that correspond to the doorways, and cards are points, and they're even more points if you cash them in. So if we're too easy to go through a whole bunch of doors at once, then the game might become a little too trivial. But it's easier to go through a door near the start of your flick than it is near the end of your flick, suffice to say. Ice Cool Wizards, also by Brian Gomez, he of the original design, published by Brain Games.
Mark, you and I played Rattle. This is by Andy Gallagher and put out by Busy Dad Games. And we talked about this a lot in our crowdfunding sort of segment. And what Rattle is this game where it boasted to be like sort of like an adventure-y type versus game of...
Cornhole meets WarioWare is the sort of tagline, and I think that's appropriate. The version that we played, there are a whole bunch of mini-games, suffice to say.
Yeah, you're tossing these little diamond-shaped... things, I think in all the little mini games, it could be something else. And you're trying to either land beside other things or away from other things, but there's like this little shoebox type of area that you're trying to throw them in. They have all these different slots where the diamonds fit perfectly, very nicely into all these slots.
For a 3D printed component, it's done to a very exacting degree of precision.
And
we're dancing around a very painful topic here.
The rule book might have been lacking. Maybe direction. A few.
One or two minor details came up over the course of any playing or even cursory. Look, I'm sympathetic. Independent producers. This is clearly a one-man operation. This is a dude with a garage and a 3D printer. All right. And I pledged largely on the basis that I love dexterity games, as is clear already from the context of this episode. And I also like WarioWare for what it's worth. And the creativity on display is considerable. The problem is that the creativity is not backed up by anything resembling the same degree of rigor. And we should just start at the beginning. There is no description in the rulebook about how one tosses or throws anything. Usually, even in flicking games, just go back to High School Wizards. They say, like, look, here's what a flick looks like.
Yes.
Not that there's even any restriction. There's no interesting restriction. We had to basically assert that, okay, so you're supposed to toss these diamonds into the board. Let's just assert that you're not allowed to put any part of your body over the board, because otherwise somebody who is not interested in making the game work, and I'm not suggesting we play with this, but we just like guidance. We're not saying, oh, our tournament stats are going to get upended. I'm just saying that if somebody, even if this was their natural interpretation, say somebody just had a wildly different interpretation or assumptions, they could hold the diamond 2 inches above the board or even 1 inch above the board, drop it and say, I tossed it in.
Yeah, or someone that has no experience with dexterity games.
Right.
Yeah.
And this is clearly how it's meant to work, right? Like, well, no, clearly not, but we wouldn't have any basis for guidance for that. That's just the start. The game is Rattle is largely driven by action cards.
How many can you play? When can you play them?
There can be one card per action.
But Mark, what's an action?
Sorry. Next, you're going to say something stupid like ask whether you mean per player or total. To that, I also have to say go to sleep. And then there are a whole bunch of mini games, and every mini game is phrased with a similar degree of ambiguity. Just to close this, I don't want to beat up too much on Rattle, because then we can get to some positive stuff.
I'm saying if we hated it, we wouldn't even talk about it at all.
Probably.
Yeah.
Or certainly not to this length. Adjacency is leveraged in almost every mini game. In order to find out what adjacency meant, and this is a core thing, does adjacency include diagonals? Everybody who's ever done anything in board games knows that this is an issue. I only know that adjacency excludes diagonals, only includes orthogonals, because I went and watched the promo video on the GameFound campaign page. That is the only place where the designer has set up a Discord. Where I've shown up, I've personally messaged the designer, I've messaged on the Discord, I've gone to the Board Game Geek page, saying, where do I ask rules questions? Crickets. Why am I so frustrated, Walker?
Because at its core, it seems like it's going to be very fun.
I know! It seems awesome! And it kind of is, even now!
The minigame we played was it was a food fight, all of the different colored diamonds were different kinds of fruit, and you're moving around, picking up fruit, and throwing it at your opponent, and yeah. Anyway,
yeah, I want it to work, and this is why a different context, a different conceit about which I was less enthusiastic. I probably wouldn't even bother, to be frank. I certainly wouldn't have put it in front of you. I would have sat down, I would have looked at the solo version, and be like, "This makes no sense," and I would have put it away, never to touch it again. But as it is, the amount of charm and the amount of creativity that's on display, and my enthusiasm for the core idea of just a collection of different dexterity mini games that Rattle presents makes me want to get it to work. And I feel like the designer and the final product is not helping me get there. And I do not like that frustration.
And the art seems odd. I went through the whole page. Nowhere does it talk about the artist or the art.
Yes. The silence there is strange. I like it. It's a whole bunch of, it's one of the more charming instantiations of anthropomorphic animals. At least it's all the same kind of animal. It's something, yes, about how, you know, the rats have taken over the world, and they're very cute rats.
And it is very good art. You'd think that this kind of art would be credited, but I don't want to say anything because I don't know whether it's AI art or not.
It's a strange moment in our hobby, right? Where you look at an art, and we experience this all the time in Pledge of Indifference. Like, I really like this art. Who made it? Did a who make this? it's weird.
And that is Rattle by Andy Gallagher.
That is Rattle. If anyone can get the designer to answer some rules questions, it's not even that I have that many in the general. I would just like a lot more clarification on the core structures. And then I'd be willing, I guess, to fudge a lot of the individual games. Because if it was just a lack of clarity on the individual mini games, that'd be one thing. But the core mechanic... Anyway, I've said my piece on Rattle. I would very much like to continue spending time with Rattle and to resolve these issues. I get to play Agricola Revised Edition. This, of course, is the perennial classic worker placement game by Uwe Rosenberg. His first worker placement agricultural game, many, many more to follow. And let me just articulate some beefs with the revised edition, because you made some complaints about Agricola 15, which is the sort of deluxe, but not really...
Self-destructing.
Explosion game. Of the revised edition that you have that came with missing fences that have yet to be replaced because it's Asmodee and they don't want to replace any components. No. That's just not what they do. But the revised edition, as it stands, I'm a bit frustrated with the state of the product line of Agricola. Not entirely unlike my frustration with the Quest for El Dorado. You know, there are a couple different editions, one of which is kind of defunct, but the one that's defunct is kind of sort of superior. Because the revised edition, in its base version, has way too few cards for the two-player game. Anyone who plays Agricola knows there's a whole bunch of occupation cards and a whole bunch of minor improvement cards, and that's where a lot of the charm comes from. Even now, it was ahead of its time in so many ways. And just the variety of different powers that you can accumulate and the combos you can try to build, regardless of how you left the cards into the system, whether you draft them, whether you draw 10, pick 7, what have you, or just the random 7. It's a splendid tapestry with which to paint. And if you play a two-player game, there's barely enough cards in the box, the base game, to play, just deal out the necessary cards. And so you're going to see the same cards a lot if you play two-player or solo.
Well, maybe if you weren't like so selfish and maybe invited people to play, you could have played a third, three-player
game. Even then, I'm just saying there's not enough cards that come with it. And so to a certain extent, I felt like I was being subjected to some sort of hostage negotiation. So yeah, I've purchased a couple of expansions to the revised edition just so I can have enough cards to think that I have enough in circulation, which is a bit of a shame. I think the base game, originally published in 2005, 2006, had a good number right out the box, and then it too had some expansions. Now, the revised edition is cleaner in some ways. They've tightened up the language. I just wish that they had not introduced a variety of manufacturing and distribution problems into the revised edition while they were doing this cleanup and this republication. It's the nature of things. It's kind of like planned obsolescence. It's the deliberately making things subpar in an effort to get you to spend more money. And so I felt a little bit dirty getting the B and C expansions for the revised edition. And I kind of regret it. It's a bit of a shame because it's a marvelous game. I think Agricola is a fabulous game. It's very accessible, but at the same time, tremendous room for improvisation and customization in terms of the different cards that are available. I introduced it to a friend of mine who was curious about it because it's held up as one of the classics of the hobby, and he was very pleasantly overwhelmed with the variety of options that he had at the outset in terms of occupations and improvements especially, but just in terms of how to develop one's farm, ultimately. Now, it shows its age in some way. You know, again, the fact that you're heavily incentivized to just run up the number of workers you have. They didn't need to make it so that you get more actions and more points by expanding your family that far. It was the classic design element of early worker placement games. But I still think that Agricola, even with its publication problems and even with minor elements of showing its age, absolutely still worth bringing to the table. Of course, there's the perennial discussion about whether you want Agricola or whether you want Caverna. Porque no los dos, I guess. But Agricola is my preferred version, and I am very happy to have returned to Agricola Revised Edition with Uwe Rosenberg, published by Lookout Games in 2016.
So we streamed a bunch of games again last Saturday. We did Almost Innocent again. E.T., the extraterrestrial light years from home game.
Okay.
More on these later. And we also played Dune Imperium Uprising. So Almost Innocent. I talked about it introducing new stuff, and it has. So there are player powers now, Mark. There's a card for every color of the game, and we got to add one to this particular game. They're going to, you know, siphon them out, I guess. So next game, we get two.
As of what scenario?
As of scenario 6.
Okay.
But still very much enjoying it. It's just that type of deduction game is just my jam. You know, I have these cards. they can't be my things. They ask questions. You sort of level it down. You get to a 50-50. Just love it. Two different types of questions. How many clues do I have in this row or column? Or is my particular, this particular clue victim in this row or column? That question goes around the table. And then you have a limited number of those questions, even the types. It's like you have a lot of the number clues, but only a few of the particular card clues.
Anyway. Yeah, I could never figure out how to do those effectively. Yeah, in very much the same way that this is your kind of game, this is not really my kind of game.
Yeah, so the power was for this one, because there are cards for all of the symbols on the board, there's going to be some cards that are left out. So the power in this one was you got to look three of these cards and then show the whole table one of them.
Oh, I see. Inform everybody that one of these indicated bits of data is not relevant to anyone's solution set.
Yeah, so we sort of waited to the end and, you know, sort of optimized, you know, which card is going to make the best effect. And that is Almost Innocent. All right, Mark.
All right.
E.T., the extraterrestrial light years from home game. This is a kind of interesting family weight game.
Was it designed by Prospero Hall?
It totally was.
Okay.
Prospero Hall, Brian Kirk, put out by Funko Games, and it has these giant meeples, I want to say meeple player pieces, that are kids on bikes with baskets.
Yep.
And then the little E.T. miniature that's two-colored, like actually painted, and it fits into the basket.
Glorious.
Exactly. So you're moving around the city. You either have E.T. in your basket or you don't. If you have them in your basket, there's a whole array of E.T. special powers that you can use. And then there's an agent for every color, and they go after that particular player. And then there's the question mark agent. He only goes after E.T. And then depending on if you're with other people or you move near one of them or whatever, then you roll these dice and that tells you how far these agents are going to move. And if they hit you, then you lose some life. And you have so much life. And it was just a great little game. You're trying to build the different devices in order to send E.T. home.
Sure.
And there are three different ones. And if you build them, they put, you know, dice in the landing zone. And then at the end of everyone's turn, they get to roll the dice. And that moves the mothership closer to the clearing. And so you're trying to get the mothership to the clearing. And the bad timer is all these squad cars that are moving towards the clearing. So they don't get in your way or anything, but they move through the map just as an interesting sort of timing mechanism.
I see.
So it was a really fun family weight game.
Are you enthusiastic about the property? Do you have fond memories of the E.T. movie?
No, it's mostly a disappointment that a director after time would go back and edit his own film.
Oh, yeah, right. I completely forgot about that. That was a product placement issue, right? Like the most overt kinds of corruption, didn't he?
No, he just didn't like the fact that all the agents had guns. So he computer erased all of the guns out of their hands and replaced them with radios. So now they're running around with radios instead of guns. Yeah.
Okay. Because I remember there being some discussion about changing the Reese's Pieces to M&Ms, I think, or something because of product placement issues.
That part I'm not sure.
I mean, on the one hand, as an edit to a movie, I don't really care. But on the other hand, it is so obviously mercenary that it seems strange. I've never really been a big Spielberg guy.
Oh.
Yeah, they're well-done movies.
Yes.
And, I mean, look, I was at the right age for Jurassic Park to hit hard, but I'm not a big Spielberg guy.
Then the last game we streamed was Dune Imperium Uprising. This is designed by Paul Drennan and put out by Direwolf. Sort of a sister game or follow-up game to the normal Dune Imperium. I'm not happy with the fact that there's Uprising in the name. There's really only one true Uprising game. But anyway, I digress. Let's move on. So,
and wouldn't Uprising Curse of the Last Emperor also be a good name for a Dune game?
Yeah, it really would. So what this changes from the base game is, you know, all the cards have changed. It adds this spy mechanism where there's sort of this spider web that connects the actions together. And there's spots to put spies on this spider web. And then you have two options. You can remove one of the spies to put a worker where there's already another worker, as long as it's connected to that space. Or if you go to that space, you can remove the spy to draw another card. Drawing cards is kind of essential in this game because it's what you're going to use to buy more cards. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to get water, you're trying to get spice, you're trying to get money, sell the spice to get the money to buy these, you know, to get these big ticket items. One that's going to give you another worker, one that's going to give you $2 every turn. And then there's all this influence as well that's going alongside.
You don't sound enthusiastic.
No, I'm not. It's the same thing. I've already said it before. It's a mediocre deck builder game with mediocre worker placement, right?
Yeah. I've never played the Uprising version. On the one hand, I'm curious, but on the other hand, I'm not, because I found the base game so very pedestrian and also vaguely stodgy in its pacing and unsatisfying in its resolution that I'd be hard-pressed to imagine Uprising changing enough of it to make me appeal. But by the same token, you know, the Zeitgeist Walker, the meta, the hype circle,
it's very popular.
It is.
So Sidewinder does what Sidewinder usually does. She says, oh, I don't really understand, but I'm just going to try this. And trying this was to do everything she could to get the worms.
Sure.
Now, normally when you put cubes in combat, they're worth 2 each. Worms are worth 3. Big thing that worms does is they double your benefit from the win.
Oh.
So if you get a victory point, you get 2 victory
points. Sidewinder crushed you, didn't she?
It was pretty terrible.
I mean, it would be natural that she would be drawn to things that are basically like snakes.
It's true.
Yeah. In hindsight, it's obvious.
So I could see that the rest of us could do this. I know why I couldn't do it, because I'm not sure if it happened 3 times, but I know it happened twice. There are certain cards. You can buy more. Don't get me wrong. I understand I played wrong.
Yeah.
Don't give me sending any emails. I don't need to hear it. Long story short, you have this diplomacy card, Mark. You get one that's a one-shot, and then one that you get to use whenever it comes up. And that's what lets you go up the influence. And you need to get at least 2 influence with the Fremen so you can get your worm hooks, so you can get the worms.
Well, you got to be able to influence the worms. They're not just going to join you for nothing.
Exactly.
Right?
So what happened twice, maybe even 3 times, was at the end of my turn, I would either take an action or play a card that would let me draw more cards. Because I want more cards. Because it gets me money.
It's a deck builder. You want more cards.
And I would draw my diplomacy card.
Ah.
So therefore, I'd go into the discard pile and I wouldn't be able to use it. I wouldn't be able to get friendly with the Fremen. I wouldn't be able to get my worms.
Sounds rough.
It was rough. More on terrible card draw later. So anyway, Dune Uprising, some interesting stuff. They did sort of pull back a bit on the silly intrigue cards that...
Oh, good.
That, you know, overly manipulate the combat.
Mm-hmm.
But there are still some.
Yeah.
But I don't feel that part was as bad.
I'm looking forward to the collaboration between Dune Imperium Uprising and Andy Schwartz, where they do Dune Envelopes of Cash, where you're trying to bribe the worms to playing for your local sports ball team.
I like it.
Yeah, I'd play that game.
I'd play that game.
I'd definitely play that game.
So that's Dune Imperium Uprising. I'm interested to show it to you, just to see what you'd think of the changes.
Sure. You know where to find me.
So I got invited to this game on Board Game Arena.
Mm-hmm.
Mark. It is called World Traveler. Now, think some sort of hybrid game of code names where you have the same sort of grid and you have your, just like the Clue Masters, you have a grid of which cards are yours.
That you want your teammates to hit.
That you know, in this case, you want to hit them.
Okay.
So you're moving a pawn around a city. And so you'll put out some clues. There's a big grid of pictures. And you have some word clues. And everyone starts in the middle. And you say, I would like to move left. And here are my clues. And that's supposed to tell the other players how far you want to move. Because it's supposed to associate your words that you put out. Have to associate with a certain picture along that arrow that you've put. I want to move left.
Got it.
And here are my words. And you have a certain number of different words. And then you have to pre-program a bunch of them. So you have all these arrows. Okay, I want to move left. Here are my word clues for that. And now I want to move down. It could be one space. It could be long. But you have to put the word clues.
So if they get the first one wrong, then you're completely off track?
All they do is that you've done all your things. You plan out all your moves. And then as a team, they go through the whole thing. They move here, move there. And then on your, like I said, on your clue card grid, did they hit the points where you get points?
Right.
The points where you get points. The spots where you would get points. I really like it. I'm can't wait. It is available now. I think I'm going to pick up a copy because I just thought it was that interesting.
So it's another, there's kind of a spatial element layered on top of a word association to picture mechanism.
Just so, yeah.
Yeah, it sounds promising.
And then it has all sorts of, I thought it was just always going to be the one map, which I didn't I didn't quite like, because it was sort of like people would associate different things with it. We played the Japan map, and people would just associate different words with the pictures that they had. You know what I mean? I just felt as though some, you know, have totally different takes on what some of the pictures might mean.
Well, that's part of the game, right?
Yeah, I suppose. But anyway, different cities.
As somebody who's been to Japan, I believe they made you honorary emperor, if I remember
correctly. Oh, yeah, I think so.
Did you feel that it was evocative of your experience in the country?
Just so. It was like being there again.
Okay. I look forward to hearing your reports of other maps of other countries that you visited. Because between the two of us, you are absolutely the world traveler.
Yes, world traveler, designed by Thomas...
Oh, Dejeuner L'Espérance.
Yes.
Thomas Dejeuner L'Espérance.
Just so. And
I've enjoyed his work in the past.
And published by Office Dog.
Excuse me? That's awesome. It's like Jorts the Cat, only dog version.
And those are the games we played this week. Now, a small break while we pay the bills. This episode is brought to you by the Spring Cleaning Champions, Manscaped. This season, make sure to groom your carpets and your drapes with the leaders of the below-the-waist grooming. Clear out that winter bush with Manscaped's Lawn Mower 5.0 and watch your confidence bloom like springtime flowers. Embrace the season and join the 10 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped with our special offer. Go to manscaped.com, use code SOWRONGGAMES for 20% off plus free shipping. And speaking of spring showers, not to worry, this bad boy is waterproof, shave in the shower, in the bath, in the ocean. Like I said, get 20% off, free shipping, with code SOWRONGGAMES at manscaped.com. That is 20% off, free shipping, with the code SOWRONGGAMES at manscaped.com. Nothing like a little spring cleaning in your pants.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet-setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
And we're back with the news and why it doesn't matter.
So, in 2010, Christophe Bélanger, a designer probably best known for his work on Dungeon Twister, published a truly, truly bizarre gonzo game of skirmish combat called Earth Reborn. It was bursting with ideas, and most of those ideas mostly worked. And... as a consequence, it was quite a compelling experience, and to this day, it's still stands quite apart from the rest of its also-rans. And he's always said that he has lots more ideas, lots more factions, lots more notions about how to expand the universe, and it still, to this day, 13, 14 years later, has a devoted audience of enthusiasts. And the designer has confirmed two things over the course of the past several months, actually. One of them is that he is still working on those ideas. And number two, there is a publisher for an expansion, and I don't know what they're going to be doing with the base content, because I don't think that people can expect to be coming in with a base game that was published 14 years ago and is now heavily out of print. It was really published by Ludicali.
This is Earth Reborn?
This is Earth
like
Reborn.
Like the buckets of plastic, yeah. So
not that much plastic.
No? Okay.
But every figure, well, it was a skirmish game. Every figure had a miniature. There weren't that many different units. And indeed, that was one of my chief problems with Earth Reborn, because each individual figure was drowning in contextually interesting abilities. It was very manageable. It wasn't like a lot of other skirmish games where it's like, oh, at the end of the game, I forgot to apply these 17 resistance. Oh, he has a pie resistance when it comes from the northwest. I forgot to apply that. Oh, no. No, no, no. This was much more approachable. But the problem was, it would lead to the same dynamics over and over again.
I thought from the year that it came out and the size of the box, that it was just, you know...
reasonable. Yeah. Most of the size of the boxes is taken up by the mountain of different rooms that are there. And it had a sort of an iconographic language that allowed each room to be its own thing. Like, for example, there's no broad mechanism for how the power goes on and off. It's just the case that some room features can be used when there's power and some room features can't be used when there's no power. And one of the rooms happens to be a generator room. And you can go to the generator room. Are you scientifically inclined? You can try to shut off the power. Alternatively, you can just smash the crap out of the generator. And all this was handled relatively smoothly by icons. There was a lot to take in, but it was really interesting. But as I say, the small cast kind of limited the horizons in a way. So, like, there was this one monster who was basically Frankenstein, and he was weak to the influence of the sniper and the human team, basically, because he was physically attracted to her. And so you had to make sure to keep him out of her line of sight because she could seduce him very, very easily. These dynamics are really interesting, but when there's a small cast, it tends to repeat, right? Anyway, so maybe there'll be more Earth Reborn, maybe there won't. I'm just amazed that the designer is willing to go back to this idea after so much time. I'm very pleased that it seems to have a publishing arrangement of some kind. No word on who the publisher is or what the distribution model is intended to be, but that's the news such as it is. Earth Reborn, possibly to be, you know, birthed again. What would be a better term for that? We'll workshop it.
Yeah, let's go back to that. So I'm always interested. Vladimir Suki seems to put out a game with from Delicious Games every year. They've announced their one for this year, and it's Rafsva. So we'll see.
It's a European city, isn't it?
No, it's a Middle Eastern city.
Oh, okay. Well, that's progress. that's a little bit different. Do I exaggerate the extent to which every Vladimir Suki game feels the same? Yeah, probably. Probably a little bit. I'd probably give him a little bit more hard time. But it's just another... Here's another historical city. Okay.
Syria. That's right.
Oh, it's in Syria. Okay. That is the news and why it doesn't matter. Yeah. Now on to our...
Sorry that we prattled on for so long. I know there's a lot of news this week. I am very sorry.
Now on to the feature game. Our feature game this week is Galactica Renaissance, or Renaissance, or Renaissance, case depending. Designed by Christian Martinez, published this year by Matago. Christian Martinez is perhaps best known for his big box game Inish, also published by Matago in 2016, a drafting slash area control game. The Galactic Renaissance is a 2-4 player area majority slash control slash depends on what victory conditions you have out game. Walker, why don't you give us an unhelpful summary of what one does in Galactic Renaissance?
Well, first, Mark, you dropped your knees and you thank the gods that this is not Yucatan, right?
Yep.
Then you look at your hand of cards and you wonder who the hell put these terrible cards in my deck. So there is a deck building mechanism. More on that later. And it's a great game because the setup is very quick. You put out some planets. And I want to get back to this because we've already talked about things being better if you have multiple plays or how bad it is for new players. And what you do at the beginning of this game is that you're drafting. I'm wondering what you thought about how that would affect new players and if the players that have played a lot have an advantage over the other ones that don't.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But I don't think that the advantage for experienced players in Galactic Renaissance could be compared to some other perfect information, zero luck games. I think that it's closer to something like Veil of Eternity than to something like, say, Antica or even more extreme, something like chess, right? And we've had some experience showing Galactic Renaissance to new players. And to a certain extent, you have to remain flexible because it's not like you have that much control over the specific combo that you're going to be building. Because the details that you draft at the start of a game of Galactic Renaissance are threefold. Number one, how many pieces you're going to start out and play. That's relatively obvious. More is better. There's very seldom a circumstance where you'd want fewer, certainly at the beginning of the game. Some planet. The planet abilities don't tend to be particularly consequential. They're important and interesting, but they don't tend to be overwhelmingly consequential. And then there's a specialist card. And this gets into the whole deck building aspect. It doesn't really feel like a deck builder. Everybody has the same set of 7 advisor cards, and to this you add some number of specialists that do other things. The specialists are really cool, and I think they're all situationally very, very useful and interesting. They're certainly visually interesting. I really like the sort of sci-fi flair that a lot of the drawings have. I would have been happier if each faction had their own unique advisor art, but at that point that's just a quibble. And I agree with you entirely that experienced players will be in a better position to know what the different specialists do. I wouldn't necessarily say that it ranks to the level of a problem.
I can see that. All right. And the only other part about the setup I want to talk about is the fact that, like some games that we enjoy where you can leave the rule book in the box, unfortunately with this setup, I don't think that's an option. There's this, you know, some fiddly bits about having certain, you know, tiles out that you just will never remember.
Yeah.
On subsequent plays.
Yeah, that's not a huge deal.
No, I'm not saying it is.
A setup summary would have been nice.
Agreed. Now, let me get back to the cards, because we just talked about them. Like you said, everyone starts with the same seven advisor cards. There's a deck of 28 different specialist cards, and why the cards, they dictate what actions you're going to take. You can take as many actions as your cards allow, because they have this sort of chaining effect. Some of them will allow you to do another action, which is normally play another card. The other interesting thing about the cards is the discard phase. After you've done playing all your actions, you just take that pile and you keep it in the order that you played them in, and you sort of flip it and put them on the bottom of your deck. So there's no discard deck. There's no shuffling your deck once you get started. You sort of can understand what order the cards are going to come back in. You know if you played your explorer and then your advisor. You know if you have your explorer in your hand, the advisor is going to be the next one coming up.
I never really tracked the order of cards to that extent, and indeed you can mess with the order a little bit. Every turn you're allowed to discard one card, and given the vicissitudes of the particular board situation, you might not want to play the cards in the same order, and so you have some wiggle room with there. There are exceptions, however. There are a couple of cards that, again, based on your proclivity, you might want to pay attention to, and there's one that you always want to pay attention to, and that is the Senator, because there are victory conditions, we'll talk more about them later. They are triggered, and you get to score them when you play your Senator. So the card that everyone will wish to pay attention to is the Senator card, because you do not score points, broadly speaking, unless and until you play the Senator card. And so consequently, it's not so much a game of hand management, it's not so much a game of deck construction management, because the specialists that you acquire over the course of the game, worst case scenario, can just be used to cycle themselves so they don't bloat your deck. Most of the time, you care very, very much about getting to your next Senator card. Now, you have to set things up so that you're playing the Senator such that you score well. But generally speaking, burning through the rest of your advisors as quickly as possible is one of the challenges of playing Galactic Renaissance well. And that challenge I found very interesting, especially given the fact that you do not shuffle your deck. If you did shuffle your deck, that there could be all kinds of weirdnesses based on how that works. Yeah.
So what, like Mark said, you have to set up first. And how you set up is that throughout the game, you start with one planet, which is the hub in the middle. And then throughout the game, you're going to be playing Explorer and maybe some other specialist cards that put out more planets. And then there's going to be scoring cards that need you to set up your emissaries in a certain way with maybe some buildings or something. And then you play, like Mark said, the Senator card, and that will allow you to score. And to move around, you need to have portals. And this is a very interesting part of the game, because your home world starts with a certain color, one of three different colors, either red, blue, or yellow. And then depending on how you explore, it's going to dictate what color the planets that are out. And it sort of makes this spiderwebby, you know, way that you can move, and really sort of hinders down how you can manipulate the planets.
As I commented last week, one of the things that I really appreciate about board games is when they have an arc. When I get a sense of development, when I get a sense of an overall structure, and where the end game doesn't feel like the middle game and doesn't feel like the early part of the game. And this is one thing that Galactic Renaissance has in spades. Because the universe starts out very small. Every player has a homeworld and there's the hub. That's it. And by the end, there's going to be at least half a dozen, probably way more, planets scattered all over the place. Some of them that are easy to get to, some of them that are very, very difficult to get to, some of them hotly contested, some of them mostly ignored. But at the end of the day, this adds yet more texture to just the development over the course of the game. And it really makes it so that the board is just the right amount of fluid. Getting wherever you want to get to, trivially, not particularly interesting in a game of this sort, although it can work. Being unable to get places can be very frustrating in games of this sort, but I felt that the adjacency system in Galactic Renaissance, plus the overall development of the board space, was just great.
And sort of the limiting cards of how, when you can move and how you can move, right? You get one big move card as your captain, pick a planet where you have lots of guys, spread them to where you're allowed to move. I really liked how they had the two different types. Either you're going to move or you're going to add. Add comes right from off the board, your dead pile, onto where it says. Move means no matter how special the move is, it still has to follow those movement rules. Only move through the portals. And then to get back to the exploring part, some of the planets have, like we said, have special abilities. And some of them even have special abilities when you reveal them or move to them or move away from them. All of this stuff adds to very interesting gameplay.
So let's talk about the victory conditions. At the start of the game, there are going to be five total victory conditions that you're going to have. And at any given time, two to three of them are going to be active. This is exclusively driven by various point thresholds that people reach. And often in games of this ilk, you can't really tell how consequential those victory conditions are going to be until you actually put the game through its paces. So, for example, you might see on, for example, a crowdfunding page or something, it's like, oh, there are 24 different victory conditions. Every game is unique. In this game, you score 1 point per corn. In this game, you score 1 point per strawberry. Ooh, feel the variety. Galactic Renaissance is definitely not at the level where every given game feels as wildly different, a la, say, Cosmic Encounter or something of that sort, but it's a little bit more akin to what I would describe in terms of Voidfall, right? There's a universe of possible game states, and you're in a position where there are a variety of different victory cards that substantially reward some game states over other game states. So, some of them are very straightforward, like 2 points every shared planet where you're leading. Any planet where you're there and someone else is and you got more, you're gonna get some points from that. Very straightforward and already encourages a confrontational style of play. Then there are a lot of other ones that might say, oh, you get points just for being at the same place as somebody else, independent of who happens to be winning. Some of them give you points for being in the minority if certain factors are conditioned. And the way these victory conditions come up in isolation is hugely consequential. The way they come up collectively is also hugely consequential. And so the amount of variety you get just from the victory conditions alone, I very much appreciate. And further adds to that sense of a game's arc.
Yeah, and they sort of add these two different types of buildings. One which is, you know, disappears very quickly. The foundation, there's only five foundation figures that can enter the game. And sort of like where they are is very consequential because some of the victory conditions will key off it. Maybe you won't even know. They'll come up and it'll just be like, oh, well, I guess we're screwed. And the other one are the institutes that are your player color. And like I said, victory conditions will say you score where you have an institute or, you know, you're with an enemy's institute. And so having them in the right place at the right time when that senator card comes up, key part of the game.
And it really does make every session feel like a slightly different evolution of the same set of pieces and same set of levers that you're pulling. And I very much appreciated that. Now, some people, as a consequence, I just want to flag, because this is true of Galactic Renaissance generally, and especially true of some conditions. For an area majority / area control, it's tough. It depends on the victory conditions. It feels like a different style of game based on different kinds of player conditions. It is simultaneously very interactive and yet not. Because, again, depending on the victory conditions, but even when not, the systems are such that a lot of it is just you trying to pump your own deck as best as possible, despite the fact that a lot of it is about shared space. So, you know, I talked about the difficulty of moving around, for example, which I find just about right. If your captain is buried in the wrong stage of your deck, or you just played it suboptimally and you're not going to be moving around for much, a lot of the challenge is going to be less from where someone else is horning in on your planets or horning in on your victory conditions, and more just, I need to find a way to get myself out of this hole. For some people, I think this is going to be perhaps a little more heads down than they might expect. For me, I just very much appreciated the variety, and I appreciated the fact that the game could breathe and develop and evolve on its own terms.
I think with multiple plays, it's going to change even further than that because there are point thresholds in which these victory conditions are going to change. So noticing that someone hasn't scored in a while and they're about to hit one of these thresholds, you can see that one of them is going to disappear. And so, you know, knowing to not work towards that and to get ready for the new one is a big part of this game.
Absolutely. And in very, very, very rare circumstances, you can actually peek at what there is a specialist that allows you to peek at upcoming victory conditions. That's a very, very powerful one. So let's talk a little bit about the specialists. This is the first overt comparison I'm going to make to Inish, because in some ways, I think Galactic Renaissance feels an awful lot like Inish. And in a lot of other ways, I feel that Galactic Renaissance is achieving and manifesting the promise that I felt that Inish never delivered on, all right? In Inish, there are a variety of one-shot cards that you can pull from, and there's just a deck of unique cards that you can pull from, and they're one-shots. And because they're one-shots, and because they're drawn in secret, and because you're never going to see them again, I never really liked the effect that it had on the game state of Inish. I felt that Inish was, overall, my problem with Inish is that I felt that it was this awkward juxtaposition of the necessity of planning so that all your ducks were in a row, coupled with weird elements of overt chaos from the game system and sometimes unintentional chaos from other players' decisions, sometimes even when those other player decisions were optimal decisions. Galactic Renaissance, I think, avoids those to a large extent because you don't have one-shots. Instead, you have these specialists that come up again and again and, at worst case, never blow up your deck. And people can start to anticipate them. Like, I know what specialists everyone else has got after they've shown up the first time. They don't have some sort of cataclysmic effect and then go away. Because of both the fact that it's slightly more solitaire-ish than Inish was, and because of the deck cycling, I feel that they have a much, much more salutary effect on the game state than Inish did.
Another similarity is there's the sort of end game, where Inish you sort of had to announce that I'm, you know, in winning contention.
Right.
And then everyone beat you down, and then the game went on for another 4 hours. in this case...
Get good, Walker.
Okay, so true. In this game, you have to hit 30 points. But the hook is that there's sort of a threshold at 20. Once you've hit the 20 mark, you have to get 10 points in a turn or else you go back to 20. So say if you're at 19 and you got 8 more points, well, you didn't hit the 30, you go back to 20.
Yes. In practice, this is less daunting than it sounds, especially after you play your first few turns where you're scrabbling to get 4 to 6 points in a given senator play and you figure how on earth it's going to happen. Oh, the game will develop. There are going to be so many planets in play, it won't be a problem getting to those 10 points. Frequently what happens is some number of players get to 18, 19, 20, and then it's just a question of who can get their senator out when they're in a reasonably advantageous game state. And that's fine. It, again, identifies a clearly delineated endgame. There's not really much opportunity to bash the leader, certainly not as much as there was in the context of Inish. And also, it's the case that the overall game flow, I think, of Galactic Renaissance is vastly preferable to that of Inish. Inish had this drafting phase, and I loved the drafting of Inish, in theory. In practice, there were a couple of elements that always frustrated me. Who's going to draft the Geass? Who's going to take the hit and stop somebody from doing something else? Who's going to start that conflict that's going to strip all those actions out of your hand unanticipatedly? Who's going to stick into the conflict way past where they should and cause everyone else to suffer in strange and unexpected ways? In Galactic Renaissance, on the other hand, there is no overall round structure. People just keep playing their turns until the game ends. And you manipulate your deck in other ways. And so you don't have to worry about someone else always hogging the explore card or what have you. Your explore is there. Just get to it.
Yeah, I want to go back to the deck manipulation because there's another very interesting aspect where you have these institutes that go out and it increases your hand size. And it's sort of, like I said, because some cards let you chain, having more cards in your hand is better. Not only
huge deal, yeah.
Huge. Not only does it give you more options, but more chances of getting those chaining effects. And that sort of... figuring out how to get more cards out. So you're going to be drawing more cards because that also, you know, that tells you how many cards you're going to draw at the end. So you start off with only having 2 cards that you're trying to play around with.
Yes. And just one more comparison to Inish. After playing my first early games of Inish, I had this sense of this is very different from a lot of other games, either in terms of just in the context of drafting / area control, but also just Euro games in general. It feels quite different from a lot of what else is on the market. And I had that same reaction after playing Galactic Renaissance for the first time, for the first couple times, actually. The big question for me was I needed to keep playing Galactic Renaissance because I went up and down with Inish all over the place. And I played Inish about, I don't know, 8 to 10 times just because I was trying to figure out how to... what I felt about the thing, and it always felt so strange and strangely fragile. Galactic Renaissance, on the other hand, feels far more robust, far more controllable, far more like I'm in a position of being able to actually play the game rather than having some weird thing come out of left field and completely destroy any elements of planning, while still having those elements of improvisation, of reacting to the specialists that come into the system, either both my own and other players. I really do get the same sense of uniqueness, the same sense of interest, the same sense of development that I got in Inish without all the things that made me frustrated with Inish in Galactic Renaissance. And so what we have is quite different from a lot of other games of a similar nature, and one that is very, very much... to my taste. I'm a big fan of Galactic Renaissance, and I really think it fires on all cylinders.
All right, there's only one more thing I want to get to, and it starts with the emissaries. These are like sort of your troops that you're going to move out on the board. So there's a little bit of figuring out how to get them from your dead out-of-play pile into the active area. And this also leads to what how the fights work, which is called Disorder. I think it's almost better to, as if you're explaining the game, you know, call them fights.
Because sure.
Because then, you know, when you say, you know, then we do Disorder, it might think that's this weird new mechanism. This is going to cause a fight.
Sure.
So all the different planets have a certain number of emissaries that they can hold. It's different. It goes from anywhere from 4 to 9. And if it ever goes over that number, then you put a marker on it. At the end of this player's turn, there's going to be a fight. And it's nice and easy. It's who the player's whose turn it is. They start, and they have some disorder options. And there's, you know, you're either...
They're bad. They're not good. They're bad.
They're all bad. It's fighting. Yeah, people.
No, they're not all bad. Some specialists get you some good options.
True. So you're either moving troops, like retreating them, or you're killing them. Or, like Mark said, you might be lucky and have some disorder cards in your hand, which do all sorts of things. And you have to do one of these things. And as soon as the disorder starts, it has to go around the table for all of the people that are on that planet. So regardless of, you know, the first person goes and now there's enough room for everybody, well, too bad. It has to go all the way around the table and everyone has to take one of these disorder options. And I love that part about the game because if you have a bunch of guys there, you know that everyone's going to take a hit. Or even if you just want to, you know, disperse a particular planet, you just have to start a fight there and then bad stuff happens.
I think I would have slightly preferred if in a given game there would be a little bit more disorder. Because, again, moving around is just the right level of difficult. And so frequently you're not in a position to start many of them. And even when you could start a lot of them, it's difficult to position yourself in a context where the disorder is to your advantage. Now, a lot of that calculus changes, though, if you have the right strategists in your deck slash hand. Because then suddenly you have disorder options which are positively good for you. Let me give an example. There's one that simply says... add one of your emissaries to that location. Everyone else is pulling them off because they have to. And when it's your turn to pull one off, instead you play this card and you add one. That's really powerful. Some of them are just flatly interesting, like the Warmonger. The Warmonger, you play it and suddenly more figures show up, prolonging the pain for everybody else, and giving you the option of removing those figures instead of one of your own. This is these neutral miniatures that come up. Really interesting stuff. I wish it happened a little bit more. I'd be happy if a couple more disorders happened, all told.
I'm wondering if it leads down to what objective cards or victory point cards
that are. That is out. True. You're right.
I'll play Galactic Renaissance anytime. And I find it far superior to Inish or any sort of interaction I had with Inish. Like I said, now that we've played it, it's super easy to set up and put away. The rules are fairly straightforward. We introduced a new person just recently, and they got it almost right away. I didn't touch the part where there are a bunch of keywords when it comes down to the victory point or objective cards.
Yeah.
And it's not as though there's, like, you know, pages, but when
it's a small number, but they're not intuitive.
Yeah, or it's just the fact that you go to 0 pretty well in the game anywhere.
Right.
To a 12 to 6.
It's a stumbling block for your first play, but after that, it's second nature. The worst offender is strong. Strong means you have two pieces there. Exactly two. Three, you're not strong anymore.
No.
You're too strong.
Too strong.
Yeah.
You're
one, not strong enough.
Mega strong.
Two, you're strong. Three, you're something else. You're not strong anymore.
Hyper strong.
No, that's still strong, though, because you're not strong.
Just normal strong.
What about dominant?
Oh, could be.
Oh, but then you might not be winning. It's all fine. Anyway, minor gripe. Massive fan of Galactic Renaissance. Would happily play anytime. It is hard to do 3-4-player area control / area majority games well. I think Galactic Renaissance does a wonderful job of it. We have not played with the 5 or 6-player expansion. I'd be willing to try. I'd have some doubts about downtime, as it is with 4. The downtime is not problematic, but it's certainly not especially zippy. So with 5, I'd be a little concerned, but I'd be willing to give it a shot.
As you know, people, the combo cards, sometimes you're playing 5 or 6.
Right.
Sometimes you're just playing 1.
Exactly.
But you never know.
Well, but that juxtaposition makes downtime especially problematic. If you're the one playing the 1, and you know you're only going to play the 1, and somebody else is doing their combo-tastic kaleidoscopic nightmare. Yeah. As I said, my enthusiasm for Galactic Renaissance is such that I would happily try it with 5, but that would not be my preferred configuration. And given that it is so good with 3 or 4, that seems like an excellent way to do it. Well, that's going to do it for this week. Thank you very, very much for joining us. And I really do mean it. I really appreciate any one who decides to take some time to spend listening to us yammer on about nonsense. It means a lot to us. It's the most valuable form of contribution you can get. That having been said, please do keep sending your money. If you want to find out any of our contact information, you can find it at sowronggames.com. There's a lot of good stuff there. We read everything you send us, and we'll get back to you if we can. Once again, thank you for spending some time with us. We hope to see you again soon. Take care of yourself, take care of your hobby, and don't forget to thank your rules explainer.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Biggin. Special thanks goes to What Does It Eat for generously allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our theme. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. You can reach us by email at soveryronaboutgames@gmail.com or on Twitter at sowronggames. Thanks very much, see you next time, and always, try to be right, but remember you are so very wrong.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.